or last week or whatever. How did the tutorial go? I heard one comment that it was pretty easy. So did everyone agree with that? Or maybe not. Okay. Oh, you had a question. Okay.
Is there like a canonical way of estimating the number of steps in
algorithm? No, there's no canonical way. In general, that can be a very hard problem, in fact. I mean, there's some algorithms that seem to be good in practice, but we can't really prove that they actually are good in general, for instance. There's also other algorithms which are good in practice but are not good on the worst cases, right? It's just the worst cases don't show up very often. So that's a bit of an art. You have to look at the structure of the algorithm. And I mean, there's certainly common techniques that show up time and again. So Ben, did you post the solutions to yesterday's tutorial?
Not yet,
but you will, right?
Yeah.
So you'll see the way I solved that Euclid's algorithm problem. Used a variant. So there's a kind of common technique where, in the case of Euclid's algorithm, the very first step you can show is that the numbers that you use decrease monotonically. So that proves that it has to converge eventually, right? That it has to stop. And then using a little trick, you can prove that they actually have to decrease exponentially. And that shows that in this case, the number of steps has to be logarithmic. But you have to really look at the structure of the algorithm and look for properties that are, for instance, invariant, and then you can say, well, this never changes. So there's a bunch of techniques, but that's not really my expertise, actually. So you have to take a serious algorithms class or theoretical computer science class that can teach you all about how to do that. But there's not a kind of a uniform standard way of doing that. Okay, other questions? Okay, so today I wanted to talk about another algorithm. And the problem is, again, a number theory problem, which is factoring large numbers. So factoring, well, I probably don't really need to explain to you what that is. You have some big number, and you want to find its factors. Okay, normally we consider the case where P and Q are prime. If they're not prime, then basically this is just easier, because there's more factors that you could possibly find, and the factors are smaller, and that helps. So the hardest case is when P and Q are both primes of about the same size. And so remember, when we were talking about complexity, we like to describe things in terms of the size of the input, so the number of bits needed to describe it. And so if big N is little n bits long, right, so n is roughly 2 to the little n, then P and Q are both going to be, when they're about equal size, they're both going to be about n over 2 bits long. Okay, and when little n is large, like 500 or 1,000 bits, this is a very hard problem as far as we know. The inverse problem which is when you're given P and Q, find the product. That's easy. By easy, I mean it's in P. Okay? And I mean, it's not only easy, this is something you surely learned in elementary school, right? Using, I mean, the long multiplication method, I guess, will take time about little n squared. But there's some fast multiplication methods that work faster than that. So this is a kind of an interesting case where going one way is easy, but going the other way is hard. And that property makes this a very useful function, the multiplication versus factoring function, that's usable in cryptography. So I'm going to tell you about that in a second. But actually, it occurs to me it's maybe worth, since we've been discussing so far in this week, the complexity theoretic part, we've been talking mostly about decision problems, yes or no problems. And this factoring problem, as it's phrased, doesn't look like a decision problem, right? It's because you're given one number and you're supposed to output two other big numbers. But so first of all, actually, you only really need to output one number, right? If you output P, then it's easy to find Q, right? If P is actually a factor of N, you just divide it into N and find Q that way. And that's straightforward, okay? But so you don't really have to output two numbers. You have to output one number. But more than that, it's actually basically enough to solve the following decision problem. So decision problem, we want a yes-no question that's basically the same as solving factoring. So the version that's usually used would be something like this. So given two numbers, now N and let's call it M, does N have a proper factor that's less than M? Okay? So obviously, if you can solve the full factoring problem, you can solve this decision problem. Because you just say, well, the factors are P and Q. Is one of P or Q less than M? Okay? But what's a little less obvious, but not hard, is to say if you can solve the decision problem, you can very quickly solve this factoring problem. Right? Because with the decision problem, what you can do is you can say, well, we're allowed to pick any pair of inputs here. Okay? So what we can do is we can start little m as big N over 2. Actually, that's kind of silly. There has to, I mean, assuming N is not prime, N has to have a factor that's less than big N over 2. So let's be a bit more restrictive. I mean, actually, N is not prime, it has to have a factor that's less than square root of N. Okay? So we could, if we ask, is M, if we set M equal to square root of N, then the answer to this should be yes. But if we set M equal to square root of N over 2, then we're actually learning some information. We're learning if N has a factor that's less than square root of N over 2. And if it doesn't, then we know that both factors have to be greater than square root of M, square root of N over 2. Okay? And suppose we know that suppose we try that, we get the answer no. We say, okay, so it must have a factor between square root of N over 2 and square root of N. So we knew there was a factor somewhere in this range. We've divided it up. And so now we know that there's no factor down here, so there must be a factor in this range between square root of N over 2 and square root of N. So what we can ask, is there a factor less than 3 square root of N over 4? Okay? And suppose the answer to that is yes. Right? Then we know that there's a factor in this range, and so we can divide this range in half again and keep on doing that. And since we're dividing the range that we're working with in half every time, the total number of times we have to do this before we narrow down the exact factor is going to be log square root of N, which is, you know, order log N. Okay? Which is, and log N is the number of bits of the input. Okay? So that's acceptable. That's just a polynomial reduction, in fact, from this factoring problem to the decision problem. Okay? So this technique of cutting in half and cutting in half again is a very common method for turning function problems like this into decision problems. Yeah?
We don't know, given a number n, we don't know that we can find two prime factors, right?
This is not part of the definition of the problem. This is just the usual case that's considered when p and q are prime. So you just want to find, what we want to find is a factor. Okay, when you find a factor, obviously you find the complementary one. That was the question, right?
Why
had to be prime? They don't have to be prime. It's just that's the case we normally worry about the most.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions? No? Okay. So let me talk about the use of factoring in cryptography. There's a crypto system called RSA, and that stands for the three people who found it. Read this. And so RSA is what's called a public key crypto system. So the idea here is we have an Alice and a Bob. And Alice wants to send a secret message to Bob. Okay? However, there's an eavesdropper, Eve, that's listening in to the communications. And Alice doesn't want Eve to know the message that she's sending to Bob. Okay? So, for instance, Alice might be sending her credit card to Bob to buy something from Bob. And she doesn't want Eve to steal her credit card number. Okay? And in fact, RSA is really used on the web when you go to a secure site as the method of establishing that secure connection in the first place. So there's lots of methods of encryption, and we'll talk a little bit next week about a quantum method of encryption called quantum key distribution. Basically, what's required is that Alice and Bob share some information in the form of a key, a secret key, that gives them an advantage over Eve. Okay, the kind of the old-fashioned crypto systems that date back, you know, hundreds, thousands, even thousands of years, Alice and Bob had the same value of the key, and that had to be secret from Eve. But there's a lot of disadvantages in that, which, again, we'll discuss some more next week. But for one thing, it's a pain in the neck for Alice and Bob to establish this shared secret key. They have to have gotten together at some point in the past and discussed it. And so, for instance, this is not very suitable if you're buying something on the web, because you know you want to be able to go to a website that you've never been to before and still be able to buy something there. What was discovered basically in the 1970s is there was a, I guess the British kind of crypto agency actually discovered it secretly in the 1960s, but it only became public in the 1970s when Rivas, Shamir, and Adelman discovered this RSA method. There's actually some slightly earlier public key crypto systems, is something called a public key crypto system. And the way that works is there's a public key that's used for encryption, in other words, to take the message and convert it into the encrypted version that's hard to read. And then a private key that's used for decryption. And the thing about this is that having the public key doesn't really help you decrypt. Okay? It helps. So decryption, of course, is to take this encrypted message and turn it back into plain text. It's called the original message. And so the public key is that even the eavesdropper, Eve, can have that. And this encryption method is still secure. Okay? And so that's a very nice system, because that means that you can send out your public key to anyone who wants it, and they will then be able to send you secret messages. But no one else will be able to read them, okay? Even other people who've already gotten this public key. Okay? So that's a much more easy method of establishing a secret communications channel with somebody than having to agree ahead of time on a private key and saying, we must both keep this secret forever, really. Okay? So how does this work in the case of RSA? So in the case of RSA, the public key is going to be a pair of numbers, N and E. And the private key is another number D. Okay. And this N is the N from the factoring problem, basically. So N is chosen to be the product of two large primes. And if you know P and Q, you can find D from E, basically. So actually, how you pick E is going to depend a little bit on knowing the factoring too. But basically, the point is that if you could factor N, if you know the, in fact, if you know the factors of N somehow, then given the public key, you can find the private key. Okay. And so the way this works is that to create the private key, Bob generates two large primes, P and Q, multiplies them together. So he knows P and Q, and then uses that to make the public key that he gives out and the private key that he keeps. And he, of course, has to keep the private key secret, because if somebody else learns the private key, they can read messages sent to him. But the problem is that because, not the problem, the advantage of this is that because factoring seems to be hard, nobody else knows how to find P and Q, even given this public key. Okay? And so therefore, they have a hard time finding D. Actually, that's not proven. So it's believed that breaking RSA is as hard as factoring N. But that might not be the case. It might be that there's some way to find D, for instance, without actually factoring. Or to read individual messages without actually factoring. But this is the existence of RSA actually is one reason that we believe that factoring is hard. Because RSA is very widely used in the real world, there's been a whole lot of effort that's gone into trying to break it, both academically and by certain government agencies. And of course, we don't actually know whether the government agencies succeeded in breaking it. But the general belief is that RSA is actually secure against a classical computer. And so the big discovery in the 1990s was when Peter Shor showed that there was a quantum algorithm that could factor large numbers quickly. And we'll be talking about that today and tomorrow. And so that really started a lot of the interest in the field of quantum computation, because it showed rather starkly that not only could quantum computers solve some problems that we think are hard for classical computers, but that they could do it on problems that actually people were interested in. Okay, unlike the Deutsch-Joseph problem, which I showed you yesterday, which was totally artificial, contrived, just to make the point that quantum algorithms could sometimes be better than classical ones. Okay, yeah.
Is there any other problem, like factoring problem, that can be used for encryption?
Yes, there's many other problems. Let's see. So there's a variety of problems related to lattices that are useful. And so things like you have some lattice in, you know, some relatively high number of dimensions. It's given by a set of basis vectors. But maybe these are not the best basis vectors. You want to find actually the shortest vector in this lattice. That turns out to be, as far as we can tell, quite a hard problem. And so there's some crypto systems based on that. For practical reasons, they're not as good as RSA, but they have the advantage that right now we don't know how to break them with a quantum computer. So another class of crypto systems, for instance, is based on some properties of elliptic curves, which, if you don't know what that is, I don't want to explain it. It's something in algebraic geometry. And those actually, practically speaking, are quite comparable to RSA. And so there's a company in, I think it's based in Waterloo, that likes to promote these elliptic curve crypto systems called the Certicom. Unfortunately, those are also susceptible to attack by a quantum computer using basically Shor's algorithm again. There's other more exotic problems that people have come up with. So one problem you face in general with crypto systems is, remember, we can't prove that any problems are hard, basically. So if you come up with a problem, a new problem, and you come up with a crypto system based on that problem, well, first of all, if it's a problem that hasn't been heavily studied, it might be that it actually isn't hard. It's just the most obvious algorithm doesn't work, but maybe there's a more clever algorithm that does. And that's, of course, true even of factoring. It's possible still that there's a more clever algorithm, despite all the effort that's gone into it, that will break factoring on a classical computer. Okay, so that's one issue. The other one is that when you make a crypto system, usually you have to be very careful, because when we talk about a problem being hard, we're talking about the worst cases being hard. Okay, but for a crypto system to work, it has to be that the cases that you actually use are hard. Okay, and so for instance, if you take two random primes, this factoring problem still seems to be pretty hard most of the time. But there's a whole lot of art that goes into RSA to make sure that you're picking the right kind of E so that it's hard, and that, you know, some primes that you pick, pairs of primes, are not so hard to factor. And so there's a lot of art going into learning all these details to make sure that what comes out at the end actually is a hard case of this problem. And with a new crypto system, you again have to be very careful of that, because there's a lot of pitfalls, and you have to learn about them before you design it. So, I mean, there's professional cryptographers that spend lots and lots of time worrying about these type of things when they design new problems. But there are actually quite a large spectrum of problems that people have proposed for crypto systems. Okay? Any other questions? Okay. Let me quickly tell you how RSA works, because it's not very complicated. The actual details here is that encryption is, you have some message X that you want to send, and you encrypt it by raising it to the power E mod N. Okay? So you see this uses only E and N, the public key. Okay? And then to decrypt, you take some message Y that you've received, and you raise it to the power D mod N. So I guess the private key assumes that you also have the public key. So you know N, and you know D, and so you can do this. And the point is, this is supposed to be equal to X again. Okay? And the reason it's equal to X is, well, we've chosen D and E so that for all X, X to the D times E is equal to X mod N. Okay? And we can do that through some number theory. So in particular, we use Euler's theorem, which says that for all X, x to the 5n is congruent to 1 mod n. And 5n is defined as the number of numbers less than n, which are relatively prime to n. Okay? So obviously, if n is prime, this says 5n is just, so if then 5n is just going to be n minus 1, right? Because, so there's a special case that 1 counts as relatively prime for this definition. And since, you know, primes have no factors, everything less than n is going to be relatively prime to it. But it turns out there's a more general case. And in fact, you can say, given the factorization of n, you can exactly write down phi of n. So for the case when n is equal to p times q, that implies that phi of n is equal to p minus 1 times q minus 1, when p and q are prime. Okay? So the way to make this work is we want d times e to give us x to the d times e should give us x to the 1. Okay? So we want d times e to be equal to some multiple of phi of n plus 1. Right? Because then x to the d times e will be x to the phi of n times k times x. X to the 5n times k is just 1 mod n. Right? Because x to the 5n is 1 and 1 to the k is 1. Okay? So how do we do this? Well, we use Euclid's algorithm. So this is one of the reasons I gave it to you in the tutorial yesterday. So if we pick a random e that's relatively prime, so it actually has to be relatively prime not to n but to phi of n. Okay, and you can try a few e's until you find one that works. Then we know from Euclid's algorithm that there exist A and B, and in fact we can find them, such that A times E plus B times 5n is equal to 1. Right? Because they're relatively prime, this was the property we got, that you get the GCD of E and 5n, which is 1. Okay? And so this, you see, is almost what we want. If you pick A is equal to D, or you pick D is equal to A, I should say, and B is then minus K, this gives us this equation. Right? D times E minus K 5n is equal to 1. Okay? And so this is, and you can see that if you're given E, and you know the factors of n, then using Euclid's algorithm, you can find d. Because knowing the factors, you can find 5n, and then just plug it into this formula. Okay? Yeah?
When you said that phi of n is numbers that are less than n, which are relatively prime to n, what do you mean?
Right. So let's be concrete. So let's look at phi of 6. It's kind of the first case where you have a product of two primes. So for 6, where should I put this? Down here. Okay, so what numbers are relatively prime to 6? Well, 1, kind of by definition, that's a little bit of a special case. 2 is not relatively prime to 6, right, because 2 and 6 both have a common factor 2. 3 is not relatively prime to 6, common factor 3. 4 is not, but 5 is. Okay, so phi of 6 could be equal to 2. And in fact, if you plug it into this formula, well, p is 2 and q is 3, so this is 1 times 2, you get 2. So that's correct. Okay? So that's what I mean. So you go through, you look at all the numbers less than n, you say, does this have a non-trivial common factor with n or not? Okay, you count them, and that's 5n. Or you can just use this formula. Oh, I just told you this formula. So it turns out, actually, so the way you can prove this is it turns out that phi of n1 times n2, I think this is true, is equal to phi of n1 times phi of n2. I think this is true. It may only be true if n1 and n2 are relatively prime. But in any case, when n is the product of two primes, then this is going to be the case. And remember, phi of a prime, phi of p is just going to be p minus 1, because everything is relatively prime to a prime. Now, to prove this thing, you have to do a little bit more number theory, but it's not too hard. Anyway, for the purpose of this, you can just take this as some given. It's a theorem you can prove in number theory. It's not especially hard. It's kind of a standard thing, actually. Any other questions? Okay. So let's move on to factoring. So one more classical thing to do first, which is what Shor's algorithm actually does. It finds the period of a function. And to factor, this is sufficient, actually. And the period that we want to find, so the function that we want to find is f of a, which is x to the a mod n. Okay? So the point is, this is periodic. X to the a mod n, well, it only has a constant number. I mean, there's only, constant is the wrong word. It only has, there's only n possible values of this function, right? Anywhere from 0 to n minus 1. So eventually, if you keep on raising to power of a, you have to get back to where you started. And in fact, we know that you get back to 1 if you do it to the power 5 of n. Okay? And so that's actually the key thing. In particular, we want to find the smallest value of r such that x to the r is equal to 1 mod n. And then r is called the order of x. So I should say that it's true that x to the phi of n is equal to 1 mod n. That doesn't mean that r is equal to phi of n. Okay? It just means that r divides phi of n. Because it could be that it gets back to 1 more quickly than phi of n. Okay? It's just that by the time it's reached 5n, it's back to 1 again. Okay. But r is really what we're going to be finding with Shor's algorithm. Okay? So how does this work? How does this help us factor? In particular, if um, if we find R, then it turns out, and this is not so easy to prove, but that with so with constant probability, if we choose x at random, that R is even. Okay? And then what we can do is let y is equal to x to the r over 2 mod n. This is something well defined. And that means that y squared is equal to 1 mod n. Okay, and this is really what we're looking for. It's because when y squared is equal to 1 mod n, that means that y squared minus 1, which is equal to y plus 1, y minus 1, is 0 mod n. So we have only a few possibilities. So we have either that y plus 1 divides n, y minus 1 divides n, or n, remember, is p times q, and n divides y plus 1, n divides y minus 1, or the factors of n, one of them goes into each of these things. P divides y plus 1, and q divides y minus 1. Okay? Now, so the point is we're breaking up this thing into two pieces. Either n goes into one of them, or the two factors of n, and n is the product of two prime numbers, so this is really the only option, each go into one of these things. Okay? And this is the case that we want. These cases are not good, but look at what happens. These cases imply that, well, in this case, this implies that y is actually equal to 1 mod n. So this is that y is 1 mod n. And this one says that y is minus 1 mod n. So so actually what we want is that y is not equal to plus or minus 1, but it still has this property that y squared is equal to 1 mod n. And it turns out, again, that's the case, that with constant probability, y is not equal to plus or minus 1. Right. So again, this requires some somewhat more advanced number theory to show that. The point is that what we can do now is we can find some random x, find the r associated with that x. If it's even, and the value of y that we get for x to the r over 2 is not plus or minus 1, then we're done, basically. Otherwise, we have to try again with a new x. Okay? Why are we done? Well, in this case, we know that, for instance, p divides y plus 1. So we can calculate it because p is then equal to the GCD of y plus 1 and n. Right. Again, we've decided that n does not divide y plus 1. And so q doesn't divide y plus 1, but p does. So p is then the GCD of y plus 1 and n. And over here, we have that q is equal to the GCD of y minus 1 and n. Okay? And we know how to calculate these using Euclid's algorithm. Okay? So if you can find the period of a number, then mod n, then find the order mod n, then you can find the factors of n. Any questions on this? People look a little bit mystified. Obviously, this is still just the classical part of the algorithm, so it's... Okay, maybe we should move on to the quantum part. That's much easier. Okay. So the quantum part of the algorithm looks like this. So we're going to have two registers. So this register is going to hold A initially. Well, not initially, but at some point. And OK, so we start out with that all zeros. And then we have another part of the register which is going to hold x to the a, another register at some point. And that will also start all zeros. And the first thing we do is we take this a register and we do the Hadamard transform on every qubit. Just like in the Deutsch-Jose algorithm, we started by doing the Hadamard transform. OK. And then what we're going to do is we're going to take these two registers and reversibly compute a classical function, which is x to the a mod n. So x is just some fixed thing that we've chosen classically, and we're going to run this algorithm with the base of x. And a is given by this first register. X to the a is calculated then in the second register. OK? And then what we could do is we can measure this x to the a register. We don't actually need to measure, but it kind of makes the explanation of how the algorithm works a lot clearer. And then we're going to take this a register and do the Fourier transform on it. And then we can measure this register. Okay, and unfortunately, then we're not quite done. We have, this is the end of the quantum part of the algorithm, but we have another classical part. We have to do some classical post-processing. And in fact, we might have to do this whole thing a couple of times and get a couple of outputs that we can plug into this classical post-processing. And that's even true for fixed x, right? And of course, we might have to try a few x's before we find one that works for this part. Yeah? I have Fourier transform the amplitudes. We'll talk about that more later. Yeah, I'll write down exactly what I mean by the Fourier transform and discuss how to actually do it in terms of quantum. But this is the big picture of the algorithm. And it, maybe it's not a huge surprise the Fourier transform goes up here. Remember, what I wanted to do was find the period of a function, okay? And Fourier transforms are good at that. That's what they do. They extract the period, okay? And that's pretty much, in fact, all that first algorithm does. It says, let's write down a function. In fact, we'll compute in the amplitudes of the wave function, basically, and then do the Fourier transform on those amplitudes, and that will find the period for us. So at an intuitive level, it's not hard to understand what this is doing. Let's see how much time we have. OK. Yeah. So, okay. So, actually, let me do this. So, let's examine this big picture a little more closely so we can go through and actually see that it does what that intuitive picture says. So, this is going to be, I call this one t times step t equals 0. Here, this is going to be t equals 1. This is going to be t equals 2. This will be t equals 3. And then this, the endpoint, t equals 4. OK. So the Fourier transform is denoted by f. And what it does, it takes the basis state A to sum over B omega to the AB B. And omega is e to the 2 pi I over 2 to the little n. And so this is not n, not big N. This is some other little n. And little n is going to be about log big N, but actually it has to be bigger than that. Okay, so this is the Fourier transform mod 2 to the little n. So it's actually a discrete Fourier transform. But it acts kind of similarly, intuitively, to the continuous Fourier transform. And I guess I'm not going to discuss too much how to choose little n, but tomorrow we'll see why it has to be kind of approximately what it is. Let's see. Right, and so maybe I should say explicitly what this is. So this x to the a mod n function, well, like I said, it's calculating this thing reversibly. So what it's doing is it's taking a and some second register y, and it's calculating a x to the a plus y mod. In this case, it is mod n. OK? So those are the pieces that go into this algorithm. So, so let's start at the beginning. So t equals 0. What's the state of t equals 0? Well, taking the Hadamard transform, remember, on all these qubits, puts them into a superposition over everything. So at time 0, which is, I don't know, maybe I could have called it time 1, the state we have is sum over a of a in the first register, and then we still have 0 in the second register. And then at t equals 1, well, we've calculated x to the a. And so what do we have now? Well, we have an entangled state. It looks like this. Sum over a, then x to the a mod n. And at t equals 2, well, what happens is we have done this measurement, okay? And so we measure the second register. The second register could have many possible values, but we pick one at random, okay? So suppose we happen to get the measurement output y. Well, then the second register certainly is y, and the first register is the sum over a such that x to the a is equal to y mod n. Right? We've collapsed the superposition, but only collapsed the part where this register differs. So all the values that have the same, all the terms in the superposition that have the same value of y remain. Okay? And the point is, r is the order of x. Okay? So x to the r is equal to 1 mod n, and it's the smallest value of r for which that's the case. So that means that this is equal to some a0 plus r, some multiple of r. So I wrote it as j. So this is equal to a sum over j of a0 plus jr y. Yeah. Say again. So x to the a equals y mod n got moved where? So this is maybe just a notational issue. I'm not quite sure what you're asking. So y is what you measure. So it's going to be some number less than n, because you're storing these things to all be less than n. When you say something is mod n, that means basically you shift it so that it's between 0 and n minus 1.
Okay.
Which whole equation? This whole equation. Yes. Yes. Right. Yeah. When we write mod, that's usually what it means. Okay, other questions? Yeah. Sum over all B. Sum over all B. Yes. So this register is actually going to be n bits long. That's this n, okay? And so this is the Fourier transform mod 2 to the n, and so therefore we want to take the sum over everything from 0 to 2 to the n minus 1. So all possible bit strings, indeed. No, A times B is actually the product, the regular product. Now, again, it's going to be mod 2 to the n, but that happens automatically here because we have this 2 pi I over 2 to the n. If you put 2 to the n in here, a times b is equal to 2 to the n, then omega to the a times b is 1. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So let's see here. So now we have to, the analysis gets a little more complicated for step 3. But we can look at the idealized case. And in the idealized case, R actually divides 2 to the n. Okay, this is not going to happen in the real case. And so the real case is a little more complicated. But when R divides 2 to the n, then what we see is that this residual term is a bunch of peaks, and they're exactly periodic. I mean, actually, you could draw this kind of on a circle, because we're doing it basically mod 2 to the little n, this Fourier transform. And the distance between these peaks is r, of course, which is what we want to find. So what happens then? So when we apply this Fourier transform at t equals 3, what do we get? Well, we have sum over j and then sum over b of omega to a times b. So that's a0 plus jr times b, b. And this is equal to, well, we can factor out this omega to the a0 times b. That's always the same. And then we have the sum over j, omega to the j rb, and then b. Right? OK, just change the order of summation here. And this thing we can evaluate using the usual types of identities that show up when you talk about Fourier transforms. So this thing is, so we evaluate this by saying if we have sum over j of e to the 2 pi I j b over alpha, this is equal to alpha if b is a multiple of alpha, and it's equal to 0 otherwise. So let's see, how do you see that? Well, sorry. It's equal to, I just made that up. It's, so if b equals c times alpha, then this gives us 1 every time. So we get the number of terms in the sum, which is supposed to be alpha. I guess I didn't say that. And if b is not c times alpha, then every time we do this, we get a phase. And it'll be phases that appear equally around the unit circle, right? Because that's what happens when you add up complex phases to various powers. And that's why we get 0. Okay. So then what does that mean? That means that this thing is equal to sum over c. That's the multiple, so we only restrict to b equals multiples of c times r over 2 to the n. Omega to the a0 c 2 to the n over r, that's this term, and then c 2 to the n over r. And there's some normalization factor, of course, here that appeared up here, too, that I've been kind of ignoring. So the normalization is going to work out automatically. Yeah?
String of bits, right? So.
Yes, no. So. A, in this register, is a string of bits. But we want to interpret it as a number between 0 and 2 to the little n minus 1. Okay? And when we do that, we can raise A to the power of that number. Okay? So we're not thinking of it as a string of bits anymore. We're thinking of it as a number. So we want to switch between those two. When we do this Fourier transform also, we want to think of A as a number between 0 through to the n minus 1. It's just we generated it by taking the Hadamard transform on a string of bits. But that's the only time we really want to think of it as independent bits. When I show you how to do the Fourier transform, it'll be helpful to break it down into bits again. But it'll still be important that it has this structure of a number, of a binary number, written as a string of bits. There is, but it's not a straightforward relation. Basically, they're different things, and little n. So what we're going to choose is that little n is going to be roughly about, I believe it's 2 log big N. Okay, for reasons that I'll tell you, but not prove to you tomorrow. Basically, it's to deal with this non-ideal case. For the ideal case, it's really all that's necessary is that this be true, okay? And once this is true, then you can do this ideal case. But for the big case, basically we wanna be able to take x to a wide variety of powers, mod n, and that implies that n should be at least log, little n should be log big N. Okay, because we're going from 0 to 2 to little n. Okay? Any other questions? Okay. So then maybe the last thing to say is, here, I'll just squeeze it in here, sorry. We'll do t equals 4. And at t equals 4, we take this state and we measure it. Okay? And so what we get is an output. This phase now, we don't care about it anymore. It disappears because we're measuring. And we get the output C times 2 to the n over R for random C. Okay? And this is not exactly what we wanted, but it's close to what we wanted. Okay? If we didn't have this C, we'd be fine, because we know 2 to the n. And so given 2 to the n over R, we can just find R. And more generally, in fact, if C and R are relatively prime, in other words, in this case, C is not a power of 2, but this is the kind of the weird idealized case, then we can find R. Okay? Because we look at this number, we divide by powers of 2, we see how many powers of 2 go into it, and if it's 2 to the little n, then R would have to be 1, but it's going to be less than that, and that will tell us what R is. Okay? And so there's various possible solutions in the general case, but the simplest one is you just measure a few times. You run this whole procedure a few times. You have to start from scratch each time, but you keep the same x, and you'll get this measurement result for a few different possible values of c. And sooner or later, you'll get something that's relatively prime to R, and then you can find R. And actually, you can do better than that by, I mean, what you actually get from this is some factor of R, right? Because if C is not relatively prime, then you've taken out the factors, the common factors. And so if you do this a couple of times, you can get a couple of factors of R. And pretty soon, you'll have figured out R itself. OK? Okay, so that's clearly the right place to stop for today. And then tomorrow we'll talk about how to do the Fourier transform in terms of a quantum, break it up into individual quantum gates, and how to do this x to the a mod n a bit, which is really just classical reversible computation, but is worth doing, particularly since it contributes to the running time of Schwarz algorithm. Okay, but are there any questions? Okay, anyway, we'll have a chance to do them tomorrow again. So I will see you then.